From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's summertime, and the living is easy, or we wish it were. Sometimes a good book helps. A good book plus a vacation in the world of cicadas near the porch, and you've got it all. We hope you've had a good reading summer. Perhaps you reached for the latest release by a favorite author. Maybe you turned to a classic. But this summer, the odds are better than usual that you've tried something new. A writer you've never read, a first-timer who's made a literary splash. This has been a banner year for first books, first novels, first collections of short stories. Check out most bestseller lists and you'll find a host of first-time authors near the top of the charts. Expectations are not usually high for first books, but after this year's success, the bar may be raised. Jonathan Safran Foer is getting raves for Everything is Illuminated. Stephen Carter is plunged into fiction with The Emperor of Ocean Park. Alice Siebel takes us from hell to heaven in The Lovely Bones. It's the summer of the rookie writer, the big first book of fiction. What does that say about the book business and, more importantly, about us as readers? Have you discovered one of these debut books? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Carol Horn. She's vice president and senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Carol Horn.
Glad to be here.
Good to have you. And from Brooklyn, New York, Mark Rozzo, who writes the first fiction column for the Los Angeles Times. Good evening and welcome, Mark Rozzo.
Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you. Mark, you spend a lot of time looking at first works. What has made this summer stand out? Why so much buzz for first books?
Well, it's hard to say. I think maybe every once in a while the publishing world turns its attention on something that may have been otherwise neglected, but also I just think that the quality of books like the Jonathan Safran Foer and the Alice Siebel is just extraordinary, and those books really are stirring up a lot of attention really on their own merits.
I just picked up this afternoon a report from The Guardian in London, and granted, this is from the other side of the pond, but they describe two journalists and two agents taking every first book published in Britain this year off to a cottage for a weekend, reading until their eyes were red-rimmed, and they came back with this. They said, why do all these first novels begin with hangovers, pounding temples, and memory loss? Why were so many of these writers, these books, concerned with what these days is called ennui? Why did so many writers describe absolutely everything in the same amount of detail, as if every sensation, every object, every feeling, the insides of mouths, eyelashes, the sound of a cup, were equally important? Why did so few have anything to say, even when they had beautiful writing with which to say it? Does any of that apply to what you see in the crop out in the U.S. this year?
Well, I don't really know. It's hard to track trends in first novels, because they're really extraordinary things. And you also have to think that often there isn't even a second novel that is going to happen for this writer. And then on the other hand, and maybe I'm making the opposite point here, is these first novels that we see from these writers are rarely their actual first novels, but it's just the first that we've seen from them.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work under that first publication.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And actually, the more that I read of first novels, and even among my many disappointments in reading them, I often have to remind myself what a brave thing this is that I'm looking at, even if it's foolhardy to a certain extent. But the other thing, Tom, is that I feel that first novels are produced under a variety of circumstances and really come from every imaginable demographic nook and cranny out there. They're written by the precocious. They're written by people on their deathbeds. They're written by farm wives between harvests. They're written by bored copy editors. Mm-hmm. The occasional drug-addled runaway is going to crank one out. And there's also...
Because there's no requirement that they have made a career of it. It's by definition the first time.
Right, exactly. So they're really coming from every corner of society and the world. And there's also the so-called workshop babies who are really pruned to crank this stuff out. That's sort of unfair because they work very hard.
But you mean the folks who are at the Iowa Workshop or others,
yes,
where they've got perhaps even big name teachers or writers who are helping them shape and craft this first work?
Sure. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting with first novelists because, and I actually asked this question at the LA Times Festival of Books in April to my panel of first novelists to get a sense of pros and cons on the idea of workshops and how they affect writing. And I have to say that my writers were split right down the middle between those who kind of disdained the workshop and preferred to do their writing in the attic, and those who pointed out, and I think quite truthfully, that workshops can be immensely helpful for certain kinds of writers.
Mark Rosa, hold that thought, because we're going to come back to how these writers get launched, how the really big ones scale the heights they do. But I want to ask you, Carol Horn, you're out there looking at all these books, deciding what to bring into your bookstore. Was it apparent to you this year, as you prepared for the summer book crop, that first books were going to be a big deal?
I think it was. I don't do all the buying. I have a colleague who works with me. Mm-hmm. And both of us kept running into each other's offices after we had sat down with someone from a publisher and saying, you won't believe this first novel that I just saw or heard about. It's really quite astonishing, I think.
Take us through, if you would, a bit of the list. Mark Rosa has mentioned a couple. Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated, and then The Lovely Bones, Alice Siebold. Take us on down the list of what's first time and hot.
Well, when you called to ask if I would be on the show tonight, I happened to pull out our bestseller list from last week, and I was a little surprised to see that the top six books were all first, either first novels or first story collections.
Now that's got to be extraordinary.
And number eight, it's a little stretching it to call Richard Russo a first story writer, but it is his first collection of stories. He's, of course, written many novels.
This is the Horse Child on the Heels of Empire Falls, so he's hardly a novice.
Right. So they are the Foer, as we've mentioned. You Are Not a Stranger Here by Adam Hazlett, a collection of nine stories. The Lovely Bones, Prague by Arthur Phillips, and The Winter Zoo by John Beckman, both of them about young expatriate Americans in Central Europe in 1990.
Mm-hmm. So Central Europe gets a couple on your top seller list.
Mm-hmm. Emperor of Ocean Park, you mentioned.
Stephen Carter, a long list of publications behind him, but this is his first jump into fiction.
Yeah, he's a law professor, and he's written primarily about religion and legal issues.
Mm-hmm.
And The Russian Debutante's Handbook by Gary Steingart.
We've got a lot going on.
Which, again, I mean, as I was looking through these and sitting around yesterday and today, we came up with about 40 books off the top of our head that have gotten great reviews, that have sold quite well. And as you say, usually people don't expect that first novels are going to do extraordinarily well. And there seem to be these themes, partly because, of course, while they do, you know, everybody writes a first novel, a lot of them are young folks. And there are these kind of searching immigration, emigration, dealing with, you know, looking for meaning and identity and all those things. It seems to really go through a whole lot of these books.
So what does that suggest? Does it suggest younger book buyers are attracted to those themes, or that somehow the whole book reading public is reaching out to themes that are dominant in these first books?
Well, I think it's partly the themes, but also I think I have not seen in a long time such a group of accomplished writers. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the fiction, the language.
It's really just there in the quality of what they've put forward.
The quality is just spectacular. Usually when I'm reading a first novel, I sort of say, well, you know, I have to give them a little leeway because, you know, it's the first novel. And there's certain kind of standard things that you think may go wrong in a first novel. Mm-hmm. Most of these have totally avoided those pitfalls altogether.
Carol Horn, reading is such a personal thing. When you look at that list of the top six of your bestsellers are our first novels or books, do you have a favorite among them personally?
I do, and I have a real favorite that's not quite on our list yet. It just came in the store. I think my favorite of the ones that I've read, and I've not read all of them, is Prague.
Tell us about it.
Well, interestingly, it's set in Budapest, not in Prague.
Right.
A group of five or six young Americans, and five Americans, one Canadian, who are there right after the fall.
This is Arthur Phillips' book, of course.
This is Arthur Phillips' book. And, you know, it sort of follows their treks around the city and their lives and loves and their trying to figure out what's going on, and all of them seem to think that what's really happening is in Prague, and here they are in Budapest.
Maybe a comment on how we all feel a bit displaced these years, but something about Central Europe that's also served as a vantage point for America.
Mm-hmm. I think, I think all of
or at least American character as it's put up against kind of the X-ray machine of the Central European eyes coming out of the Cold War and into the world.
Right. These are more about the Americans and less about Central Europe, although Central Europe is used as kind of wonderful backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really looking at American young people trying to figure out who they are and where they're going in their lives.
Mark Rosso, how about you? What are this crop of first books has smitten you?
Well, first of all, I'm really impressed by Carol's bestseller list. I had no idea that the top 10 was so clogged with first novels. But for me, I have to say my sentimental favorite is The Lovely Bones by Alice Siebold, who is someone I've known since 1983 when she was my first writing teacher.
No kidding.
I had to obviously recuse myself from reviewing her book. But
where was that, Mark?
That was at the Pennsylvania Governor's School for the Arts when
wow.
I was 16 or 17.
So she was teaching writing in 1983. This is her first
yeah.
novel, but she's no novice.
Exactly. She's been, I don't know if she would really want me to be telling the world this, but I admire her for that. She's devoted pretty much every day of her life since then to writing, and she published a wonderful memoir about 2 years ago called Lucky, and has published in small presses. So she's been very active and very busy, although this is the first time that she's been exposed to a large audience.
Describe the book for readers who haven't had time to pick it up.
Well, actually, Tom, I'd like to describe Everything as Illuminated, because that's actually one that I did review for the LA Times, which I really enjoyed and was...
This is Jonathan Safran Foer.
Yes.
He'll be joining us in a few minutes.
Right.
But
this
please.
Is Jonathan's book, and the amazing thing is, kind of unlike Alice, is that Jonathan, I believe, is 25. You might want to check with him.
I think 24 when it came out, and now 25. I think.
Yeah, and this book is sort of beyond precocious. I felt in how good it is. There's really sort of nothing that you find like cloying about it, or you don't really get irritated or alienated because the guy's so young and talented, which is great. But there's this real sense of mischief to the writing.
And this is the story of an American who goes back. To look for the roots of his Jewish family destroyed in large part during World War
yes.
II. He's back in the Ukraine, and
yes.
it's woven through with another tale that the protagonist is writing about
yeah.
His grandfather from the 18th century or ancestor anyway.
Right, and there's so much going on in the book that's about language, and it's about storytelling, and it's about memory. And it's just fabulous how much is going on. And it's also... incredibly funny. I mean, they're just jokes upon jokes upon jokes. It's kind of like at certain points you get a sense that it's kind of like Fiddler on the Roof meets Mel Brooks meets McSweeney's. It's just incredible.
With a little bit of David Eggers mixed in.
Sure.
That sort of new, very self-aware, self-conscious kind of writings at some point.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely some of that going on. And often the word irony is used as a sort of blanket description of that new kind of writing. It makes it sort of easy to just not think about what it's doing. And I wouldn't want anyone to think that of Jonathan's book, because it has so many layers to it. And the way that it uses irony is in a really...
very rich.
Yeah, rich, interesting way.
Mark Russell, let me ask you this question. You specialize in first books. We just got a few seconds before the break. But can you, in a blind taste test, can you identify a first book?
I would have to say probably not. There are certain trends in first novels of late which would probably enable me to identify one if I come across a book that's a farce about the modern workplace.
Good chance that it's a new book or a young book, but not necessarily a first book.
Right.
We're talking tonight about the summer of first books. It's this summer. What first books have you been reading? What special expectations do you bring to a first book? And what does this summer's bumper crop of big first books say about the book business, about us as readers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the summer of first books, a lot of big first books on the bestseller lists, making the buzz, making people talk and think and feel. What first books have you been reading this summer? What does the summer's bumper crop of big first books say about the book business, about us as readers? And do you reach for a first book or tend to look more to known and seasoned authors? Do you fantasize about seeing your own first book on the front table at Barnes & Noble's? You can join us tonight or at the Harvard Bookstore.
Thank you.
We're joined tonight by Carol Horn, who's vice president and senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and by Mark Rozo, who writes the first fiction column for the Los Angeles Times. You're welcome to join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jay's on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, great discussion. I wanted to bring to the attention of the panel a wonderful first book by somebody called Jan Martel. The book is called Life of Pi. I don't know whether any of you have heard of this.
Tell us about it, Jay.
It came out this summer. This is basically, my understanding is that the author is from Montreal,
okay.
And he writes the story from inside the mind of a young Indian boy who is the son of the director of a zoo in Pondicherry, India.
Oh, it's a great premise. It's a great premise. And what grabbed you about the story?
Was that, and the story goes that through the zoo and the experience in the zoo, he kind of reflects the multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy that India has become. And then, ultimately, when the family tries to migrate to Canada, there is this tremendous shipwreck in the middle of the Pacific, and he gets marooned with this Royal Bengal tiger.
Oh, yes, I have read about this. That's right.
Called Richard Parker. And they ultimately land up in Mexico.
We've got quite a tale. Carol Horn, I see you nodding your head. You know this book, Life of Pi, by Jan Martel, starting in a zoo in Pondicherry, India, and ending up marooned with a Bengal tiger. It's a compelling framework there.
Yeah, it's really an interesting mixture. It's almost allegorical in parts, and yet there's this sort of high seas adventure aspect to it that's really great. It's really a nice mixture of kind of spiritual quest and just funny.
Mark Rosa, what do you know about Jan Martel?
Well, I have to say I love The Life of Pi. I wrote about it in the New Yorker, and I found it to be just an extraordinary shaggy dog story. It was just outrageously twee, kind of reminiscent of Kon-Tiki in parts. And also I have to say that Richard Parker is probably the most extraordinary feline character that I've ever read.
That is the name that the author has given to the Bengal tiger. What's Jay? You're there. What's the meaning of being marooned with a Bengal tiger? What does Jan Martel work that for?
Well, there's actually a little more to the story of how the tiger got named. Hello.
Yes, we're here. We're all ears.
Well, it was on the basis of a clerical error. This tiger was found as a cub in the jungles of Bengal, and the British hunter who shot it was named Richard Parker. And so when he was filling up when the clerk at the railway station in Calcutta was filling up the forms, he kind of misplaced the name of the hunter and the cub. The cub was called Thirsty. And the name of the hunter was Richard Parker, but the clerk kind of mislaid the two and named the cub Richard Parker.
Oh, boy. And on it goes. Jay, thank you so much.
Which is very typical in Bureaucrates, India.
Right. Know. Thank you for sharing your joy in the book. And here we go with the wonderful accoutrement of India, which seems like it is an endless supply of fascinating circumstances and names and people. But this is not an Indian author, Mark Rozo.
No, it's not at all. He's a Canadian writer. I'm not really that familiar with his earlier work. It should be pointed out that Life of Pi if I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken, is not Martel's first novel, but the first of his novels to be published in the United States.
Ah, so sometimes it's just the first one to make it across the border.
Right.
We're talking about first books and first books you may have been reading this summer. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Cecilia's on the line. Hi, Cecilia. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I own Westwind's Bookshop in Duxbury, Mass., and
right.
I was happy enough to have had Norman Gattro, who wrote Serum. And it is not his first novel that he's written. It's the first one published in the United States. He lives in Wakefield, Massachusetts. And I found it a wonderful story about three generations of a Maine lobster fisherman family off the coast of Maine in the beginning of World War II.
Give us the title again, Cecilia.
The title is Sea Room.
Room, as in headroom.
R-O-O-M, correct. And we were fortunate enough to have Norman down to Duxbury to speak about his novel. I enjoyed reading it and didn't quite realize it was the first novel till I had finished. And I found it just a wonderful story. I immediately became swept up into it. It discussed also not only the life of lobster fishermen, three-generation family off the coast of Maine, but also half boat models and shipbuilding was part of it as well. So
it's got all the elements of a summer read. And the author's name again?
Norman Gattreau, G-A-U-T-R-E-A-U, and he's from Wakefield, Massachusetts.
Great. Cecilia, thanks so much for calling in. Carol Horn, we mentioned earlier the Lovely Bones. It's had a lot of attention this summer. It's got this extraordinary premise. It sounds to me, and no slight intended here for your former teacher, Mark Rosa, but it sounded to me like a made-for-Oprah kind of narrative line. But tell us a little bit about the story that this book describes.
Well, the narrator is Susie, a 14-year-old girl who is in heaven, who disappeared a few years before mysteriously. And she's watching her family and friends as they kind of struggle with trying to figure out what happened and their grief and their pain at her disappearance.
But not so very mysteriously. You learn right off in the book that it was rape and murder.
Yes, but they don't. The reader knows that, but not everyone else knows.
Susie narrates. So. She tells the reader right off the bat what happens, but she's got a very kind of matter-of-fact tone about it as she looks back on these events from her perch in heaven.
One of the things with fiction, and particularly as I sit in bi-fiction, is that a plot summary almost never works to
Isn't
let you know
truth?
Whether something is worth reading or not worth reading. You could have exactly the same plot, and it could be really, you know, dreadful.
So what is it in Anne Siebold's voice that's bringing people into this book in such numbers with such satisfaction?
Well, she's such an accomplished writer. I mean, she has been writing for a long time. This is her first novel, but by no means her first published work. And as you say, it totally avoids sentimentality, which you immediately think, oh, my God, this is going to be just incredibly syrupy. And it's not at all. And it's just fabulously written.
There it is. Mark Rosa, we know she was your teacher. You recused yourself from reviewing it. But,
right.
but what do you think has drawn people to this book so?
Well, I think it might have something to do with the fact that in some ways reminiscent of the Virgin Suicides, the Jeffrey Eugenides book that was very popular back in 1993 and spawned the also quite popular film, that it deals with issues of adolescence, which are always fascinating to readers, I think, and also with, and particularly with The Lovely Bones, with the contemporary, ever-present issue of, especially now, as we see in the news, of murder, abduction, all that kind of good stuff. Mm-hmm. So it automatically will make a reader curious to know about it. And she sort of performs a high wire act with it by taking this kind of familiar headline kind of story and really going through it and turning it into something much deeper and surprising and very intense.
And very successful in that way. We're talking, Dan, about the summer of first books. We're joined by Carol Horn from the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Mark Rozzo. He writes the first fiction column for the Los Angeles Times. You're welcome as well. What first books have you been reading? We're at 1-800-423-8255. And we're joined right now by Carl Lennertz. He's publisher, program director at BookSense and former marketing vice president for Random House Books. Good evening and welcome, Carl Lennertz.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Carl Lennertz, we wanted to ask you, we're aware in all aspects of life of being marketed to these days. Uh-huh. Is there something about first books that publishers particularly like putting out or that reviewers particularly like picking up? Is this driven wholly by the quality of the books, or are fresh young faces or fresh faces being pushed because they sell better for some reason?
I think everybody enjoys a sense of discovery. The editor who first sees it, the bookseller who first hears about it, the reader who first sees it, the reviewer. People want to discover a new writer first and kind of tell their friends about it. And then once the book comes out and it's wonderful, it's got the power like Lovely Bones, the word of mouth spreads. But it's discovery.
And yet we've all heard the stories of slush piles and manuscripts that can never even get to an agent. What is it, or how does it work that an unpublished writer or a first-timer cracks through that?
Well, there are a lot of books that do come out each year, and some, I think, more than we are aware of, do make it through. I do think right now we're in the throes of some hardcover price resistance, and Carol knows this better than I. A lot of time is spent on the hardcover, but then a year later in the paperback, the book really takes off.
Hardcover price resistance, meaning consumers don't want to pay the $29.95 or whatever it might be.
$24, $26 on mm-hmm. a first novel.
Mm-hmm.
But they hear about it, and you combine that with the reading group phenomenon. A year later, people just turn out in droves to pick up Peace Like a River, which didn't crack the New York Times list, but won our independent award.
And who was the author there?
Leif Anger, Midwestern writer, first novel.
Peace Like a River.
Right.
Terrific novel.
Next Tuesday,
really?
August 20th, the book comes out in paperback. It's going to be a huge bestseller and was really only on the radar nationally in independence a year ago now. And people just, in paperback, books just explode after doing okay in hardcover.
We've talked about Everything is Illuminated, The Lovely Bones, The Emperor of Ocean Park,
right.
And some others here. What's catching your eye at BookSense, Carl Lennertz?
Well, we just collect what we hear from the independents around the country. There's 1,200 independents who tell us what they're reading. And Die from Clausen's Pier mm-hmm. was very early on the radar for independents back in June. And, Carol, I think you love that book. And it's interesting, the Good Morning America and Today Show picks, I'm sorry, we're talking about TV when we're on the radio, but they really picked up where Oprah left off and put a stamp on some first fiction.
So you're saying that even the void left by the great Oprah has been filled by folks who are open to first fiction?
Yeah, I think she created a marketplace for challenging fiction. I think the books you've been talking about are, you know, to put labels on it, literary and commercial, challenging, but yet accessible, and the next book on the radar, well, it's beyond the radar, Prague by Arthur Phillips.
Yes, we've spoken
okay,
about that.
You got that one.
Very, very positive reception.
And it's just an exciting time for new voices. And
Carl Lennertz, do you think this is a one-off this year, or are we going to see on our guest Carol Horn's bestseller list at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that the top six of her bestseller list are first time, our first books? Is this a pattern that's going to be repeated, or is this just lightning striking this summer?
I think it's been around for a while. I think this summer it's a combination of, I think, three of those books were tapped by the national morning shows.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would have done well anyway. But I've been, you know, Carol and I have both been doing this about 20 years now. Every summer, every fall, we see first novelists come along, and I think it's interesting it's happening in the summertime, which has been quote-unquote beach reading, you know, whatever that means. But people really want a good, challenging book for the summertime. Carol, do you agree?
I do. I was struck by, I mean, there are some lighter first novels out there, but the ones that we're really selling best are literary, they're challenging, they're not people's typical idea of beach reading.
No.
So but the Nanny, what is it called, Nanny Diaries?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the lighter side, I guess. This is by Nicola Kraus and Emma McLaughlin, describing sort of the experience of a nanny working in a dysfunctional, affluent New York household. taking mm-hmm. care of the kids while they're all away? Is that selling for you?
A bit, not much.
Mm-hmm. It's got the big movie deal already.
I'm sure it has.
it's a guilty pleasure. I think people do read a serious book and then take a break for the next one. A mystery, you know, a thriller. People do take breaks.
Leave us with a last first book suggestion, Carl Linnertz. What else is on your mind?
Well, I think there are a number. There's a guy who broke through last year. Ella Minow P is the title, by Mark Dunn. A small press did him last year, and Vintage is coming out with him in paperback this September.
And give us a sense of the book?
Like Carol said, the plot is so hard to summarize. It's about a small South Carolina town where the tiles are falling off the town hall, and when the tile falls off, that letter is banned from the alphabet, and people can't speak it, say it, write it.
We'll be left with that as a tease. Carl Linnertz, thank you very much
for
joining us tonight. Carl Linnertz is Program Director at BookSense, and you're welcome to join this conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Anne is on the line. Welcome, Anne. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I enjoyed The Lovely Bones. However, I found it so sad that I just was, frankly, glad when I was finished with it. It was beautifully written, but I loved The Dive from Clausen's Pier.
This is Ann Packer.
Yes, I loved Ann Packer's book.
What caught you about it, Ann?
Well, I thought it was very character-driven. It just read very well. The only thing I didn't like about it is that it kept me up for two nights in a row till 4 in the morning.
Give us just a sense of the book, Anne.
Well, it's about a young woman who lives in Madison, Wisconsin.
Great town.
Yeah, who's been dating the same man for many years and expects to marry him, but she's getting very bored, and she really wants a change. And he's kind of showing off because he has a sense that she's getting bored with him. And he dives off Clausen's Pier to show off and becomes a paraplegic.
And everything is changed.
Yes, everything is changed. And she moves to New York and has a life there for a while, a romance. And it was just very, very interesting. I won't, you know, go into what she finally does.
Will you go back to Ann Packer when her next book comes out?
Oh, I definitely will.
So the hook is in deep.
I mean, yeah, I really liked it. I'm a huge reader, and I love fiction. I rarely read nonfiction, but I just loved it. I have to say that Calvin Trillin's book, the title of which escapes me right at the moment, but they'll know.
This is one of his food books? Or?
No, it's about parking in New York.
Oh, okay, okay. No first-timer, but you can't help but share it with us.
Oh, well, it was, I mean, I laughed so loud that I just think everybody heard me laughing.
Anne, we love huge readers here, and we thank you for your call tonight. Thanks so much for joining us, and there's a vote for The Dive from Clausen's Pier. Mark Rosa, your thoughts on that book?
That's actually a book that I haven't had a chance to read yet. Unfortunately, I can't read every first
So many novel. First books out there.
Yeah, there are a lot out there. And for me, I read probably 6 or 7 a month for my column. And then, of course, you know, some of these other books that come down the line that have tremendous expectation around them, you know, we might do something else with them in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. So. Mark Rosso, Carol Horn, stand by. We're talking tonight about the summer of first books. Are you ready to put your mind and imagination in the hands of a 25-year-old rookie? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the summer of first books. First books are all over the bestseller list, making a big splash everywhere you turn. Novels, short story collections. I was just looking today at, is it Melody?
Maylie Malloy, we decided.
Maylie Malloy. We'll come back and talk about that. But here's the question for you listeners. Are you ready to put your mind and imagination in the hands of a 25-year-old rookie? Do you look for the well-kept wine of the 45-year-old first-timer? And what first books are stacked on your beach blanket? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Carol Horn. She's Vice President and Senior Book Buyer at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Mark Rosso, who writes the first fiction column for the Los Angeles Times. You're welcome to join us as well. We mentioned the book, and the name is just escaping me. Half in Love. Maile Malloy. Is that the right pronunciation, Mark?
I believe so.
And I have, you know, just jumped into this and couldn't get enough of it. She's writing short stories of kind of Montana ranch life. And just in the middle of Ranch Girl today, talking about, I was just reading where she's talking about the guy, Dale. He's never been to vet school, Carla says, but he can feel an embryo the size of a pea inside a cow's uterus. You've heard Dale use that line on girls before, the protagonist thinks to herself. And then about Carla, she wears a high-collared white gown at her wedding that hides the scar on her neck, half a running H from the time she got in the way at branding time, holding a struggling calf. I love this flavor right out of Montana. Have you read some of this, Mark Rosen?
Yeah, I have. I really enjoyed that collection. I thought that just stylistically, she had such a delicate touch that there was this amazing contrast between the delicacy of her language and the sort of ruggedness of her character.
Yeah, so clean and straight to it, and yet you're right, so much rugged life going on there. And in that story, the protagonist having to kind of make a decision whether she was going to stick with the Montana ranch life and everything that entailed, or let herself join the kind of cosmopolitan American mainstream, go off to college in the East and jump into that world. Great, great collection of short stories, Half in Love by Maile Malloy. Ken is on the line. Welcome, Ken. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Well, good to have you.
Question, I don't have a great new book to recommend, but my question is sort of the perennial, how do you decide which books you ought to buy? Meaning, I use the New York Times Book Review, which is pretty good, but it always leaves me a bit behind the curve, and it was funny to hear you talk about a Montana book, because I'm sitting with a hard copy cover of Breaking Clean by Judy Blunt.
Mm-hmm.
I do have Rick Moody's Black Veil. But I was sitting on the beach with my daughter while she read the hardcover copy of Nanny Diaries, and I was reading the paperback of Gap Creek.
So you're still behind the curve, you mean you're not quite up to the minute.
I'm not sure that's bad, because mm-hmm. I read the CD reviews in Rolling Stone, and you never really know. They're you know, is this only one track that you're going to want? And it's not quite the same with books, but I'm always curious.
Always wrestling.
Decide
what to jump into. It's a great question, Mark. Sometimes it's like buying that bottle of wine, and the little description praises it. But is it worth cracking open? Well, we've got two interesting perspectives on that. Carol Horn, share yours first. You must have readers who come in all the time and say, you know, what should I read? How do you help them decide if of a first book is a book for them?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious answer for everyone is that you find out what's out there and what's new and what's good by going to independent bookstores.
Nobody said because the chains don't carry first-time books in such abundance you'd like to have the trade?
Just because I believe in independent bookstores. I mean, I'm not saying anything about the chains and what they do or don't do. But one of the things that a lot of our customers like is that we have a staff recommend section.
Mm-hmm.
The staff is getting galleys and advanced reading copies ahead of time and reading things. And when they fall in love with something, they write it up. And that's a very popular section of the store. The BookSense program that Carl, who was mm-hmm. on earlier, runs, has 76 recommendations that come out bimonthly, and that's a terrific thing. Certainly reviewers mm-hmm. are very important. And I think that The New Yorker, especially in their little short takes, does some of the most interesting.
Those are pretty handy. And Mark Rosa, this is your stock in trade for first fiction. Do you think of yourself as a buyer's guide?
Well, I don't know. It's funny. I never really think about it as buyers. I think of it as a reader's guide. And I suppose that I'm faced with some of the same questions that a potential reader would be faced with in a bookstore.
There's the ocean. Which ones do you pay attention to?
Exactly. And because there are so many. And often, you know, you make mistakes. For, you know, Winter Zoo is a book that came out, I believe, in mid or late June. That's one that I'm going to be writing about next week, just because it kept getting shuffled and, you know, in the deck up and down. But I also want to sort of jump on
this. This is John Beckman's book, The Winter Zoo.
Yeah, exactly.
And did you feel behind the curve on that?
Especially after this conversation, I feel really behind the curve on it. but what Carol said about indie bookstores, I think, is absolutely right. There's an independent bookseller in my neighborhood, and I have to say that I probably live in the neighborhood with the greatest concentration of first novelists in the world. That independent bookstore is enormously helpful to me when I feel like I've missed something and I can go in. There's something about an independent bookstore with actual living, breathing people in there who read books that is really helpful for people looking for new things to read.
Well, there's two votes for the independent, but of course this year, as these books do so well, I'm sure the chains are moving them as well. Jeff is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Well, I've come across a book that I saw some good reviews for by Angela Zeman. It's got a great title. It's called The Witch and the Borscht Pearl.
Okay. And it's got our attention.
Yeah, it's I read the introduction and the reviews by other people, and it takes place out on the East Coast in a small town there, mainly for tourists. And there is a environment called the Borscht Belt that I have never heard of before.
Well, well known when you get to the East Coast.
Oh yeah, well. Yeah, the lady, it's called, the Witch and the Borscht Pearl, and the protagonist is the main mystery solver is the witch, and she develops cultivates a sidekick, and there's comparisons to them that they're another kind of Holmes and Watson, and with a little bit of humor thrown in.
So there's a detective element here. And did it put you off or attract you to the book, Jeff, that it was a first time, first book?
Well, I saw that she'd written a lot of well-received short stories, and this is her first novel. And I decided to check out the reviews on Amazon online, and it had a lot of really good reviews.
There you go. That's how it works these days. Jeff, thanks so much for your call. Let's get one more call. Barb's calling from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Barb. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Real well, thanks.
I'm enjoying the program. Just quickly say I had read what I understand to be a new author. Her name is Barbara Robinette Moss, and she wrote a book called Change Me into Zeus's Daughter. And I just found it quite fascinating. I would guess her to be in her maybe 40s, maybe early 50s now. But it was the true story of her growing up in pretty severe poverty in the South as one of seven or eight children born to a father who was quite an abusive alcoholic that kind of struck the fear into the heart of the mother and all the kids and whatever.
That's a theme we know. Barb, our time is running down, and we're having some trouble with your line, but thanks. We'll take your recommendation, Change Me into Zeus's Daughter, and thank you very much for your call. Mark Rosa, before we let you go, do you see a common theme, or are the first books out there just as wide-ranging in their themes and attitude as their more mature seniors?
I think they're probably as wide-ranging, like I was saying earlier, just the stunning variety in terms of where these books come from will ensure that there's a variety in themes. It's interesting to me that certain themes seem to rise to the top of the bestseller list. I'm not really sure why that happens, but first novels are really, they're all over the map. There's something out there for everyone.
Mark Rosa, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Pleasure to be here.
Mark Rosa writes the first fiction column for the Los Angeles Times and joined us from Brooklyn. We were supposed to be in touch tonight with Jonathan Safran Foer, but we had technical problems doing that, and I apologize to our listeners for that. Carol Horn, it's been great having you on. Thanks so much for coming in, and keep moving those first-time writers.
I will. There's one I want to mention.
Please do.
The Heaven of Mercury by Brad Watson. It's the best of all of them.
The Heaven of Mercury. Brad Watson. We'll pick it up. We'll read it. We'll talk about it next time. Carol Horn, senior buyer at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us. Continue this conversation online, listeners. You can go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a new approach to camps for overweight kids. This is On Point. Between 15 and 25% of all teens and preteens in America are obese. For decades, many of these overweight kids have been sent to so-called fat camps, sleepaway programs designed to whip them into shape and maybe starve a few pounds away. But Camp Kingsmont takes a different approach. The Western Massachusetts camp focuses not on quickly shedding pounds, but on creating a fun environment designed to build self-esteem and encourage healthy lifestyle changes. 13-year-old T.J. Henry is attending Camp Kingsmont this summer. In this radio diary, he explains why he travels from Texas to Massachusetts each summer for weight loss camp.
I came to this camp because most other camps, they, like, starve you, and they make you do stuff that you don't want to do. I heard from some of my friends here at the camp, like, they went to other camps. There's this one camp, I'm not going to say the name, that one of my friends went to, that they pushed him so hard that he almost had a heart attack, is what he said. And I don't want to go to a camp like that. Basically, here, you have a lot of fun. The counselors here are nice. They help you with your issues, whether it's whenever you first get here, if it's hard for you. They will not push you, but yet they want you to at least get in and have some fun and exercise. Whenever I first got here, I looked at this place and I thought it was like one giant hill. But now that I'm here right now, it's like this is so easy. I've been overweight most of my life. When I was about 10 years old, I was diagnosed with a thyroid disease, which explained for some of my weight, but the rest of it was from me eating too much and stuff. Whenever I was younger, when we lived in the country, there was nothing to do there. So I would sit inside and I'd just watch TV and become, as they call, a couch potato. And not really get that much exercise because it'd always get too hot. It changes you kind of in a way where you think differently whenever you go home. Before I came here, I would go out and I'd eat junk food all the time and stuff, and it'd be all greasy and full of fat. Now, after my first year here, I can't eat anything with grease in it because it makes my stomach upset. It makes me want to throw up. My first year here, I lost 25 pounds, and through that whole year that I wasn't here, I only gained 5 of it back, which I'm really proud of. Like, you look at yourself and you see that you're slimming down and you don't want to stop, so you keep going and going, and it feels good. I was walking down the street one day, and I saw this big, overweight guy there eating a jelly donut, getting it all over himself. And sometimes I think of myself as whenever I grow up, I turn out like that. But now that I've been to this camp, it's really gone the other way, where, like, I dream of myself right now becoming a federal lawyer in the court of law. Whenever I first came here, I thought that I wasn't going to lose anyway. And it just changed my life after the first year because then I knew that I could do stuff. I'm not, like, handicapped or anything. It made me feel like I could do anything that I wanted, whether it was, like, my dream of becoming a lawyer or whenever I was younger, I wanted to be a big football pro. Now I know that I can actually do that.
Terry Duane T.J. Henry attends Camp Kingsmont in West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. The 13-year-old hails from Katy, Texas. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Tim Skog, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.